based on the arguments today, it seems like there are at least enough justices who are taking Trump's claims of immunity sort of seriously.
I do not think that the court is taking Trump's specific claims of that he is being mistreated and that he should not be prosecuted for what he did as alleged in this indictment. I do not think there are five votes to sustain Trump's position there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I am not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me, of which there is much. But quickly, I want to remind folks that we are hosting a live taping of this podcast and the Next Level podcast at 6th and I in Washington, D.C. on May 15th. Tickets are still available. It's a huge venue, so come see us. All right, man.
All right.
So, a lot of news today.
Has anything happened?
A lot of legal news.
Involving any money in particular?
I barely know where to start because there's been so much. And in fact, we had to drop like three different topics, even though I wanted to cover them, because we really only have time to talk about the oral arguments on the immunity case, Trump physically being in the New York courtroom, which I know you were up there in New York watching
Tuesday,
that.
Yeah.
And I also want to get to these indictments in Arizona, just as a little dessert at the end, the people who got indicted in Arizona. Okay, so we're going to start on presidential immunity. So to remind folks, this is part of Jack Smith's January 6th election interference prosecution against Trump. We did a deep dive into this question when the D.C. Circuit issued its favorable opinion for Jack Smith earlier this winter, saying that presidents are not absolutely immune from criminal prosecution, which seems reasonable. So the crux of today's argument was about whether presidents are immune from prosecution for official conduct and where the line is between official conduct and private action. So a lot of the people, like our friend Judge Luttig, I saw him, he tweeted a thread, you know, and I gotta say, I sort of shared his reaction because I listened to the oral arguments. I was concerned. I sat there being like, and let me ask you this just as a framing question. To me, the question is very simply, this guy refused to engage in the peaceful transfer of power. He asked people to go find votes. He encouraged violence on that day. And any number of, he was pushing false electors. The question is, can he be held criminally liable for those actions? To me, like, that's the only question. Mm-hmm. But it's the what the Supreme Court justices and the lawyers were debating in this sounded to me like we have to make a decision for all time about just what kind of accountability presidents have. And so the lawyers for Trump are arguing you need absolute immunity to the point of if Joe Biden decided that Trump was corrupt and was going to decided to kill him as part of an official action, Trump's defense lawyer, or I don't know if it's a defense lawyer, but Trump's lawyer said, yeah, that would be covered under the official action. And to me, I sat there being like, this is insane. Like a healthy democracy would not be having this conversation whatsoever. And yet, as I listened to it go on, I think this is why Luttig and why I felt pretty unsettled is it felt like they were taking it not just seriously, like I assume they take everything that comes in front of them seriously, but it seemed like they were, especially that four of the conservative judges were like, yes, this has merit. I'm deeply concerned about whether or not somebody could actually hold the president accountable after he leaves office. So just what do you think? Am I overreacting? What's happening?
I tend to think that people are overreacting.
Okay.
And let me take a few steps back. I didn't see the full thread that my friend Judge Luttig put out. But I did see an initial post where he basically said that he found it disconcerting that the Supreme Court was talking about every case other than this one. And I agree with that, except I'm not sure how disconcerted I am or should be. I absolutely agree that this argument, and I think this is what is confusing people and throwing people off, and maybe they're right to be disconcerted and afraid and fearful. This argument was pretty much like a law school seminar on the next 10 cases that the Supreme Court might see and hear in the future over the next 300 years, if we have a republic that lasts that long, on the question of to what extent presidents, former presidents, can be prosecuted for acts while in office. And I mean, I don't think any of those cases are ever going to reach the court in our lifetimes. I just think that you know, they're trying to answer hypothetical questions they're thinking about the case in terms of setting a rule that would answer at least some of the justices, that would answer hypothetical all sorts of hypotheticals in the future. And there's a limit to what extent you can really do that. I mean, there is something to be said about what we lawyers called sort of the common law approach, which is you develop a narrow rule to decide a case on a particular set of facts, and you think about what the consequences could be for future cases, but you don't overthink it, because the problem with trying to set a bright line rule for all time is that you cannot possibly foresee all the different permutations of human activity that could possibly result in litigation in the future in the same subject area. And you know, you don't know. You just, not only do you not know how people are going to behave on Tuesday, you don't know how they're going to behave in September, and you certainly don't know how they're going to behave in the year 2065. So I think that there was a little over abstraction of the case in the Supreme Court. But that said, I mean, that does happen, particularly in appellate arguments, particularly now in the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court really does, for a bunch of different reasons, view itself as really a court that decides, not just individual cases, but law, rules that are going to govern for all time. That being said, they don't always do that in every case. Like, for example, the 14th Amendment case, they just decided we're just going to decide this one case just to get it out of the way and decide it with a particular result. I think this case is one where I don't really believe that any of the justices, I want to go through the transcript later, and maybe there's something that will catch my eye that will cause me to say, "Oh well, I misled Sarah," in which case I would apologize.
But don't mislead me, man.
I would not do that. I mean, I wouldn't. How would we get these nice products if I did that? I think that I don't think there is any justice who would not, on strictly, if they were just saying yes, yay or nay on this case with these facts, I don't know that there are any justices who would say that Trump can't be prosecuted for this. I could be wrong. We'll find out in a matter of weeks. I do really think that they are concerned, and not unjustifiably so, with the next case and the case after that. And let me tell you why I think people who are jumping at, to criticize the Supreme Court in this particular moment might want to reconsider how critical they're being. And maybe I'm being contrarian and Pollyannish here, but, it is possible that there could be an unjust and unconstitutional prosecution of a former president. Let's say some guy is elected, I don't know, in 2024 and takes office on January 2025, and he's some kind of a narcissistic sociopath who cares nothing
cool
about the law.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not saying this could possibly happen, but yeah. I mean, it's possible there might be somebody who fits that description and becomes president on January 20th, 2025. And his sole mission in life, because he doesn't care about the country, doesn't care about the Constitution, doesn't care about the rule of law, and only cares about himself, and is angry because he feels he has been mistreated by everyone in society, including people who turn the air conditioning too high for him in a courtroom in New York City, for which he's being tried for fraud in his personal business.
Hypothetical.
I mean, hypothetically, if someone like that were to become president of the United States,
sure,
God forbid,
God forbid.
He might appoint some attorney general who might start looking, you know, maybe a guy. I'm not going to name names, but there was some, there was a particular name I saw on a tweet today who could be, you know, who might be the type that this person would appoint, would start looking at prosecuting anybody who has shown political opposition to the that newly elected president, including former presidents. And so, you know, there may be, I don't think it's unwarranted or untoward to consider the possibility that something bad could happen in the future and that you want to basically lay down a marker that prevents that. And I think there are different ways you could do that. I think there has been some writing, which I actually have been persuaded by in the interim period since the D.C. Circuit's opinion, like that, you know, for example, if it may be the president does not have absolute immunity, I believe, for criminal acts that he commits while in office. I firmly believe that. If the president accepts, to use a hypothetical that Chief Justice Roberts used today, if the president accepts a cash bribe in order to, I don't know, what was it about? Was it the ambassadorship or was it, what was it? He used the example of a cash bribe to commit an official act. I think that should be prosecutable. I think that it should, and I think, I don't think that anybody on the court disagrees with that. I do think, though, that there could be circumstances where, I don't know, the Congress passes a law that's directed at a particular administration, and somehow it gets a veto is overridden, and it's like if the president fails to prevent. X number of people from crossing the border.
Right.
He shall be sentenced. He shall be tried and convicted he can be tried and convicted for, you know, something we'll call it grand negligence of the highest order and be subject to execution. There's these nightmare hypotheticals, and that would, you know, conjure up some of the extreme hypotheticals that the Trump people have been putting together. And I think that it's not crazy to want to basically say, we're not deciding all those other cases, but this case, you know, we at a minimum, this. So I don't think the discussion today was all that disturbing. I think it's going to, the question is, where they actually come out, and is there some kind of a limiting principle line that puts this case where it should be and leaves open for another day, or protects the presidency from abusive retribution, retributive, is that the word? Prosecutions in the future.
All right, so let me just say this back to you in what I think is normal speak, and you tell me if this
okay,
is
did
accurate.
I, was that too,
no,
that
it was
too
pretty
legally?
Good. It was pretty good, because I think I understood it.
Okay.
So what you're saying is you think the discussion today, where they wound through all these hypotheticals and tested the arguments, kicked the tires really hard on both sides with a ton of hypotheticals, was actually them trying to decide whether or not, how to think about deciding this question in a broad way so that it applies to every future case, and then thinking through how they might narrow that so that it doesn't have to apply
and
to every future
and
case.
And it could be. Sometimes you'll see courts engage in these wide-ranging discussions and not a hint of it shows up in the opinions.
So why did the New York Times come out right after and say, like, based on the arguments today...
You mean the fake news New York Times?
Yeah, New York Times.
I'm just joking. Failing, yes. I love the New York Times. I'm a subscriber.
And they basically said, based on the arguments today, it seems like there are at least enough justices who are taking Trump's claims of immunity sort of seriously.
Yeah, I don't think I would phrase it that way.
Well, I'm probably phrasing it wrong, actually. Let me
tell you how I would phrase it. I do not think that the court is necessarily, maybe some justices are, maybe a couple are. I can't exclude that possibility. I do not think they are taking Trump's specific claims of that he is being mistreated and that he should not be prosecuted for what he did as alleged in this indictment. I do not think there are five votes to sustain Trump's position there. I do think that in making the arguments that he should have this absolute immunity, he's, you know, he is raising some concerns, and it's that are legitimate, that there could be abusive prosecutions if you had the wrong kind of president in the future, and those are worthy of concern. And I guess I think if I had to say, there's this old adage that I'm sure you've, I mean, everybody's, a lot of people have heard of, even who aren't lawyers. It's like, I think it's something that was like, hard cases make bad law. Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking about it on the car ride over here. You know, bad people make hard law. Bad people make hard law. They make it hard. And we have a bad person, and the bad person is both on the other side of the V, but he also could be on the front other side. He could also be the one leading a prosecution, and dealing with a bad person and creating a rule, you know, so that we can have nice things is hard. So, you know, that's what this is about. And it's not just about Donald Trump in his capacity as a criminal defendant in this case, or in the Georgia case, or in any of these cases, it is as much about what if you had a Donald Trump bringing these cases, and that's a legitimate concern. And so I would say to people who are alarmed by this argument, that they should be taking some of the concerns that Justice Alito and some of the other justices that some people in the audience might not be fond of taking those seriously, because those questions that he's asking, you know, about corrupt attorney generals, you know, that can happen. That could happen sooner than you think. So again, that's the thing about the law. I'm not going to talk about the majesty of the law or whatever. I'm talking about the thing about the law is, when you are trying to understand it and apply it and make it, mm-hmm. you have to kind of flip the script sometimes. You have to change the names and change the characters and say and change the hypotheticals to say, well, okay, what if the shoe is on the other foot? What if the bad guys are bringing the case and the good guys are being prosecuted? And is there some kind of rule that you can distinguish with that? And that's not easy, but that being said, you don't have to decide in one case every case that could possibly come in the future, as I've said, because you can't predict the future.
Okay, so I'm going to just try to restate this again.
Okay, that was very wordy, right?
Yeah, but I'm going to try to restate it again. What you're basically saying is, okay, so they're kicking the tires on this thing, but they could still easily, narrowly rule that Trump is not immune from prosecution in this instance.
Correct.
And either
I mean, like, a lot of, I will concede that a lot of people disagree with that now, but I
think people are panicked.
I think they're overreacting.
What would it be like if they granted, I mean, I think because since we're all just dealing in hypotheticals here,
okay.
If they granted,
we are swimming in hypotheticals.
They granted,
we are swimming
presidential
in abstraction.
Immunity.
Yes.
First of all,
that would be bad.
Well, yeah, right?
Yes, like, that
I
would
think
be bad.
The idea of Donald Trump getting elected and feeling untethered to the law is
that
profoundly scary, but it's also just scary for the country. And it's interesting, one of the things you're saying that I think is important when you have a bad person, right? When people talk about Donald Trump testing our institutions,
yes.
This is what we're talking about.
Yeah,
right?
He's like, testing it every which way.
Because the hypotheticals that everyone, those existed before.
Correct.
Those hypotheticals were always here.
He wanted to prosecute. He was trying to get, Trump was trying to get Bill Barr to prosecute Joe Biden in 2020. Remember?
Vaguely.
Yeah. I mean, there was some, why aren't you going after Biden? I think there were a couple of instances.
I remember
I read
the
about
perfect
it.
Phone call to Zelensky where he definitely was trying to get them to investigate Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he is testing our institutions. He's forcing questions
right.
to be answered that
bad
otherwise
people
we
make
hadn't
hard
had,
law.
We hadn't had an occasion to really think about. But I got to say, so this guy, John Sauer, argued for Trump. And then this guy, Michael Dreeben, argued for the Justice Department. I mean, I heard the part where John Sauer made I've always thought that one of Trump and then the people around him's their superpower is just how shameless they are. And so he was able to, like, argue with a straight face when I believe it was Sotomayor said, so Joe Biden, like, could kill Trump as part of an official act because he deems him corrupt. And you would say that that was... He's immune from prosecution.
I mean, look, that was the SEAL Team 6 problem they had in the D.C. circuit. I mean, they are arguing for the broadest...
And he was like, yeah.
They are arguing for the broadest possible immunity because they need that. Because Trump's conduct, while it didn't involve actually him ordering or causing someone intentionally to be killed, was so extreme. They need the broadest formulation of absolute immunity from criminal prosecution that you can imagine. Because once you start making too many concessions on that, you can cede your client's case because it's so extreme. And that's his problem. And that is actually why I'm – part of the reason why I'm fairly optimistic about the case is that there's just no way you can let this go if you're the Supreme Court and say, yeah, this shouldn't be prosecuted without letting everything go, including the SEAL Team 6 hypothetical and the murder of a political opponent.
Okay. So they've got to draw some guardrails around
Correct.
This. Okay. Okay. That makes me feel sort of better.
Okay.
How'd you think they both
I mean,
did
you want them? Some – I mean, I don't have any, you know – relaxation pills for you,
but I'm trying to do it with my words. I'm trying to take a real chill pill all day.
Can we get a new sponsor for that? Is that kind of okay?
Yeah, if anybody's got some anti-anxiety meds they want us to hawk, let me know. Okay, so
Big Pharma comes to anyway. Never mind.
Did you think Dreeben was good?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dreeben was all there's Dreeben. Dreeben is the most amazing advocate. I've seen him argue a couple of times in the past. He is always prepared. His arguments are seamless. He knows the facts and the law inside out. And one of the things that it just like amazes me when you actually watch Michael Dreeben in a courtroom is all lawyers come up with their books and their papers and the notebook. And you're up at the Supreme Court. The fact of the matter is, and I've argued there once, you really don't get a chance to flip through your notebook. But it feels good to have a piece of paper in front of you.
I'm not asking the questions that are on here.
Right. No. But Dreeben goes up to that podium in the Supreme Court with facing the nine with not anything other than his bare hands. And he just answers the questions, recites cases and citations and record materials with nothing to look. He just has no, not even as a safety blanket. He just goes up there just, you know, for lawyers, that's like not having paper is like being naked. And so I just have this, I have always been in awe of Michael Dreeben. And I thought he was his classic self. And one of the things about Michael Dreeben is that, you know, he has argued, I think a few years ago before he joined the Mueller team, he had argued his 100th case in the Supreme Court. So he's probably argued 110, I don't know how many. And they have such immense respect for him.
What about Sauer, the other Trump's guy? Did they? Because they jumped on him hard out of the gate.
Yeah,
but then...
I think my general rule about oral arguments is that the side that gets the most questions usually loses. And this is a case I think that's an exception to that. And it's an exception to that because the Trump position was so extreme. It didn't take much to just say to dismiss it. I think they were already dismissive of the extreme position they were taking before they got into the courtroom. I think that extreme position was demolished by Judge Pan a couple months ago. Yeah. So I think that the fact that they didn't they did beat up on him some. I just think that there was sort of no point to beating up. How much can you beat up on somebody who's basically saying that the president can conduct a coup and not be prosecuted unless he's first impeached and convicted? I mean, yeah, there's just an amount.
We're going to pay some bills here. We're going to do one of George's favorites. Our first sponsor today is Factor, which has greatly improved the lives of the people working in my office who fill our communal fridge to the brim with Factor meals. And you also love them, don't you?
I do. I order them at home. I have them at home. And you can, you know, you can order as many as you like or as few as you like. And then if you're going away, I've been spending a lot of time in New York lately for you know, to watch a certain person, you know, face the music. So I went on my app and I said, oh, I'm going to skip delivery this week because I've got four or five still in my fridge and they've been there for a week. I don't want to have more and, you know, collect it all up. And then, you know, when I get back to town again, and I'm going to, you know, I go back, I can raise it. It's great. It's great. And I can change. I can do, you know, keto diet. I don't really want to do that. I could do the chef selection. There's just all sorts of choices that you can have. You can throw in some protein shakes and some breakfast.
See, needs to up what they're like, giving us
this
here.
Is like, I can write this copy. I'm better than the copy.
Well, I have to read this copy now.
Okay, so now you have to read it. Yeah, I've already done the plug.
Okay. I know. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto, like you just said. There are pancakes, smoothies, and more, so you can discover a wide variety of
easy options. I haven't
done
the pancakes. I do want to try the pancakes.
Okay, great. For the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. There's no prep, so there's no mess. Factor's meals are ready to heat and eat, so you don't waste valuable time in the kitchen.
Well, the thing you do have to do, you have to take a little fork sometimes and kind of pop the...
That sounds like a low labor
intensity.
Even
I can do that, yes.
Yeah. You can get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week, just like George was talking about. Plus, you can pause or reschedule deliveries anytime. Yeah, you pretty much nailed the plug, which means Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. And they've done the math. Their meals are less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. See, look how great he looks. Nutritious and delicious. Trust me, everyone in my office is obsessed with these meals, and I expect many of our listeners will be too. Head to factormeals.com/askgeorge50 and use code askgeorge50 to get 50% off your first box. That code is askgeorge50 at factormeals.com/askgeorge50 to get 50% off. I think I've said that enough times now, so you get it. Okay.
Nicely done.
Thank you. We have a clip. Can we listen to this clip?
Yes.
Just to give it a sample.
But he ordered the military to stage a coup, and you're saying that's an official act.
I think it would depend.
That's immune.
I think it would depend on the circumstances whether it was an official act. If it were an official act, again, he would have to be impeached.
Well, what does that mean, depend on the circumstances? He was the president. He is the commander-in-chief. He talks to his generals all the time, and he told the generals, I don't feel like leaving office. I want to stage a coup. Is that immune?
If it's an official act, there needs to be impeachment and conviction beforehand because the framers viewed that kind of
if
very
it's an
low
official
risk.
Act, is it an official act?
If it's an official act, it's impeachment.
Is it an official act?
On the way you've described that hypothetical, it could well be. I just don't know. You have to, again, it's a fact-specific, context-specific determination.
That answer sounds to me as though it's like, yeah, under my test, it's an official act, but that sure sounds bad, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly sounds very bad, and that's why the framers have... And that's why the framers have a whole series of structural checks that have successfully, for the last 234 years, prevented that very kind of extreme hypothetical.
Yeah. And okay, so, I mean, that was pretty much, that was sort of a shorter and sweeter version of the exchange this same lawyer, John Sauer, had with Judge Florence Pan two or three months ago.
Why was he more ready for this? Like, he was going to get this.
I know, but there's no good answer. He doesn't have a good answer. There is no good answer. The best you can – the instinct is when if he had conceded it right out front, it would have been just as bad. So he's throwing in – there's a little word salad, a little evasion, a little dance to the left, dance to the right. And then finally he kind of says, probably, yeah, I guess. It's like, okay, that's the weakness of his position. And – basically, one of the reasons why there wasn't much to, you know, I mean, he got a lot of questions, but there was a limit to what you could ask him when he's taking that position, because it's like nobody, none of the nine are going to take that position. Okay? They're just not. It is not going to happen. And so this is why I say this was sort of an exception to the general rule that the side that gets the most questions usually loses. Here, this guy was basically not being that helpful because he's not articulating a position that even a majority of the justices will want to take. Whereas you've got Michael Dreeben, who is representing the United States Department of Justice, and it was basically asked at one point, although it should have gone without saying, you're speaking for the Justice Department as a whole. Yes, I've, with the Solicitor General. They use the government to educate themselves and to test out positions. They really use, I mean, there was a book written, I don't know, 30 years ago, probably at least by I think is a journalist named Lincoln Kaplan called The Tenth Justice. And it was about the office of the Solicitor General. And here he's not in the Solicitor General's office, Dreeben was, although he is. He's not now, but he's with the special counsel. But he was with the Solicitor General's office for decades. They use the government's lawyer at oral argument, particularly one as experienced as a Dreeben, as a seminar leader, to talk about the things that sort of are interesting to them, to try to understand where they could go, where they don't want to go. And sometimes it does get far afield. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could get just a completely abstract discussion in the court.
Well, they were talking about like independent counsels at one point.
Right.
Like, what does this have to do with anything?
I mean, I didn't. Yeah, there was one point about the independent counsel where Justice Thomas, I thought that was actually a favorable question for the prosecution, because he was saying, that's not really in this case, is it, counsel? Which means it's sort of like, okay, he's clearing out the underbrush and focusing on what's really at issue, which is the immunity issue, and not giving them the chance to make this BS argument that some amicus curiae make. But anyway, setting that aside, this was a skull session in a lot of ways. They just want to say, okay, what are the implications of things that we could say? And it may well be that because they can't fathom what those, or they don't really see what those implications can be, you can't clearly foresee them, you may end up with a really, really narrow opinion, notwithstanding the fact that this was kind of a wide-ranging midnight skull session in a law school dorm room in many respects.
It sounds like I thought it was interesting, or I was told by other lawyers that it was interesting that Sauer sort of waived his right to a rebuttal, because apparently that's really unusual, but it sounds like what you're saying is, yeah, like, but there was nothing else to say.
That's right. I mean, I think that I am here. I am departing from the conventional wisdom here, and it could be I'm going to be totally wrong. I could be totally. I mean, who knows?
We might need to get another conventional lawyer.
Yeah, and someone who's not, yes, somebody who's sane, right? Somebody who's calmer and saner, doesn't wear funny hats and doesn't like to do product placement.
I don't know. I've heard you're a very great lawyer.
Yeah, but normally, when you're in court and you think you're ahead, you want to sit down as quickly as possible. I'll give you an example. The one time I argued before the Supreme Court, it was like, okay, I was up second because I was the respondent, the person opposing the appeal, and my adversary got the shit kicked out of him. And there was no question I had at least 7 votes out of the 8 who were sitting. Sotomayor was recused. And so I'm thinking, okay, I want to make this short and sweet. And there's this yellow light, or there's a green light that goes on when you start arguing. There's a yellow light that goes on when you like have a minute or two left. And then there's a red light that says time's up. They used to be a lot stricter with the time.
This thing went on forever.
Yeah, but they used to be a lot stricter. I mean, Rehnquist was just totally like boom, he'd cut you off in the middle of the word. Chief Justice Roberts isn't like that. He'll let you finish your sentence. But I remember it's like, okay, as soon as I see any light twitch, or if I find some stopping point earlier, I'm going to stop.
Yeah.
Okay, I just remember thinking, just get up and get down. And now in Sauer's case, I don't think it was that he thought that he was going to win on his crazy extreme argument. But I think he realized there was nothing good that could have happened to him if he stood up for rebuttal and then got, worked on by Kagan and by Sotomayor and by Barrett and so on about the extremeness of his position. Because they would have just gone by. He's like, it's all been aired already. And plus, it's, you know, the one thing you have to always consider in court is when lunchtime is.
Yeah.
It's important because you have to respect it. You know, the justices lose patience at some point. And maybe they wouldn't have asked any questions.
You don't want angry Supreme Court justices.
And at the same time, it can cut the other way that because they want to go to lunch, they may not want to ask you questions. But who knows? You just don't want to take the risk. So I think I wasn't as surprised that he waived rebuttal because there was nothing else he could have said that he hadn't already said. And there were plenty of things that he could have gotten drawn back into that would have been just, you know, more back in the muck again. So I think he made the right decision, but I think he made it for reasons that are different than what a lot of people are saying.
Okay, last question before we do some product stuff. To me, it seemed like there was a difference between the women and men. Again, you just mentioned Barrett. Barrett seemed quite incredulous of these arguments. And whereas, am I wrong? But were the four women, didn't they seem like maybe they were...
Yeah, I actually do think, well, I don't know whether they were roughly in the same place. I'm not sure exactly where Barrett is, but I really do think we are seeing some interesting dynamics among the women. I think we've seen that in some of the opinions. I haven't, you know, I'm not a sufficient Supreme Courtologist where, you know, I sit there and I spend all day dissecting the arguments and to really pass a judgment on it. But there is something going on there. There is a positive dynamic among the women. I think it's shown by the fact that there was this, I think we all saw that was on television at once, that there was some kind of panel discussion with Justice Sotomayor and Justice Barrett, and they're trying to, you know, they're all happy trying to get along. And I think, you know, I how much of that is gender based? I you know, someday somebody will write a book and we'll figure it all out. But I kind of like it.
Yeah, I'm not trying to. I don't even know why.
No, it's interesting.
I was just like struck by.
It's interesting because look, it's a small cloistered institution of nine people, and no one's really in charge. You have a chief justice, but he can't really boss the other ones around. His power is the power that he has is the power to assign opinions, but other than that, it's the power of persuasion, and he's trying to bring them all along together. So he can't. You're dealing with, you know, so people have likened the Supreme Court to nine separate law firms, you know, with nine partners, and then they're little associates or law clerks writing opinions, and then the people typing it up and stuff like that. They're like nine little law firms, and none of them really control each other. And it's when you swap one out. Or two, one out. It's like you can change the dynamic of the court. You know, it's like any small group that you've ever participated in. You take out a member and add someone else. Take two out, the character of the group can change. And it's sort of, this is a fascinating dynamic. And I think years from now, people will be writing about it. Maybe not too far from the future.
We're going to do one more ad break. So, with Mother's Day coming up, I wanted to take a quick moment to appreciate not only the moms, but anyone who's taken on the role of caregiver. You do everything for everyone else, and now it's time to do something for you, starting with your skin. Today's sponsor, OneSkin, has a simple, scientifically validated routine that keeps your skin looking and feeling good, and here's the best part, it also targets the root cause of aging. The secret is OneSkin's proprietary OS1 peptide. It's the first ingredient proven to switch off the aging cells that cause lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. And they've got several studies to back it up. I've been using their products for a while, and so were you, right?
I ordered it on Amazon.
Are you hooked? I'm hooked.
I mean, I know, here's for a dumb reason.
Yeah.
Okay. I like the fact that it's just like two things. Because there are other skin regimens that you have like this and that. It's too complicated for boys. Okay.
Uh-huh.
I cannot deal with it. This is like, okay, this is your face. And this is your eyes. That's it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I liked about it is they had some travel size version that came with this nice little travel kit that is big. Then you can shove a lot of other stuff in. And I really like that, too.
People underestimate the value of the travel sizes. Because when you travel a lot, I do, then you want to, like, take something with you. And, like, the big bottles, they don't always, the airports, you know, they have all things about them.
Yep.
So listen, don't just take our word for it. OneSkin has over 4,000 five-star reviews and was recently recognized by Fast Company as one of the most innovative brands of 2024. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on the cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using code AskGeorge at oneskin.co. I have OneSkin right here. And so since you've already tried it, but they sent us some, but you had to buy it.
I bought it on Amazon and I didn't have the code. I'm a schmuck.
I'm going to give this to you.
Thank you.
You guys can send me more.
Thank you. I'm going to open it right here.
And remember to get 15% off your first order by using the code AskGeorge when you check out at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code AskGeorge. You do so much for others. Try OneSkin today and do something good for yourself this Mother's Day. And after you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support your show. This one that you love right here, and tell them we sent you, Sarah and George.
Can I do it for like my day instead of Mother's Day?
Yeah. Gonna we just do this on the show? Great.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. It's great.
It's refreshing, also.
Good. You look fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
The dew on the morning grass.
Absolutely. Hey. You have anything for my hair?
I don't. And we're looking for hair product sponsors.
Okay. Yep.
New York election interference hush money trial. You're there.
Yes.
What's it like?
It's a trial. I wasn't there on Monday. I was there for, 3 days of the jury selection last. I can't even remember the days of blurring. I wasn't there on Monday when they had the opening statements. I was there on Tuesday. Yesterday, no, 2 days ago.
Today's
Thursday. I can't even figure it out. It was the gag order argument, which took about an hour or two at the beginning, and then a good chunk of witness David Pecker's testimony. And I don't know what's been going on today because of, thanks to the Supreme Court. But it, oh, by the way, which makes me just, I just love this fact. They had to leave court early on Monday. They had to, they were going to go to 2, but they only went to like 12:30 because a juror had an emergency dental appointment.
Yeah, I read that.
Meanwhile, this former narcissistic former president of the United States who thinks he's entitled to do whatever he wants whenever he wants it, wanted to come to Washington today for this oral argument, which he would have contributed absolutely nothing to. And court said, no, sorry, you're on trial here. So juror over indicted former president.
Yeah.
It's just, there's something so fitting about that and so appropriate in a country where we seek equal justice under law that I just had to note that fact. But anyway, so Tuesday, the gag order argument went horribly for Trump's lawyer. And it was to the point where there should be a mercy rule in court sometimes, it would have come into play there. And he was basically Trump has engaged in at least, by the time of this argument, 10 violations of the gag order. There were more, but I think that what happened was the prosecutor decided, let's just pick these 10 and go in on those. And the arguments that Trump's lawyer was making were just terrible. I mean, one was kind of, well, this was a retweet. And it's like, well, it's a retweet, but he actually changed the language of what he was retweeting in some of that. And the prosecutors pointed out that Trump loves to brag about Truth Social, how it gets his message across, and it just, it magnifies everything he has to say. And he's retweeting some nasty thing about a witness. Well, he's basically adopting that statement. So the judge was not buying that at all. And the other argument that Trump's lawyer seemed to be making was that the president was merely responding to political attacks made against him by Michael Cohen, by a witness. And it's like, okay, there's no exception for that in the gag order. It says thou shalt not, talk about witnesses. And there's no exception to that. And then when the court tried to press counsel on, okay, what exactly are you saying that Trump was responding to? He couldn't answer. Couldn't point to a single thing. And it was just brutal. And it got to the point where Justice Mershon said to counsel, to Trump's counsel, essentially, you're not helping yourself here. You're losing all credibility with me. And when a judge says that to you, that's like, you're getting squashed in a way that is just extremely unpleasant and really bad for your client.
What's the judge like in this case?
He is a very he's a very straight-laced, very disciplined, very even-tempered guy, and he's just very businesslike. I like him a lot. I think he's conducted himself in an A-plus fashion. I think he's a model trial judge from what I've seen so far.
Well, that's good. And then what about the jury? Like, were you there for that?
Yeah, I was there. For jury selection, the press, except for like I'm technically pressed there because I'm writing for The Atlantic, which you should all subscribe to. We didn't see the jury. We could only hear. It was piped into us. The jury selection, and I wrote about that in The Atlantic. And what I thought struck me about the jury selection was, it was just really kind of mundane in a lot of ways. Yeah, sure, occasionally there'd be these interesting answers to questions, but it was all very, very orderly and very, it was tedious the way court proceedings often are and frankly should be, particularly in a case where you're trying to be very, very careful in making sure that the people on the jury are fair-minded. And then on Tuesday, when I attended and saw after the gag order argument, I watched they had David Pecker on the stand, and he had not on Monday he had just testified for like 20 minutes of preliminaries, and I got to watch David Pecker. I didn't get to have a good view of the jury because I was on the side of the courtroom that the jury was, so I couldn't really see all of their faces. They were kind of like parallel to my line of sight, mm-hmm. the way they were seated, so I wasn't really watching the jury, to tell you the truth. But I was watching Pecker. I had a clear view of Pecker, and I thought he was just a tremendously effective witness. And it's hard. What makes a witness effective is, how they answer the questions and how they just sort of are even when they are answering the questions. And I just thought he looked like a guy who was just telling the story the way it happened, and it looked very credible. Now, that said, we're going to see what kind of cross-examination they will have on him. But if he has the same demeanor on cross, he'll concede some things that he has to concede. It doesn't strike me that he's going to play the wise guy or get rattled.
Did he get indicted? Like, why? So he. Just for context, he's the editor of Inquirer, right. Who was doing catching.
Yeah, he ran American Media Inc. I think it was, and they own a bunch of magazines, including the National Enquirer.
Like those garbage magazines at the grocery store aisle.
Well, you say they're garbage. People could pay good money for those.
Okay. Well. Okay.
So basically, the theory of the prosecution is, and I think it's pretty compelling, is this: the payment to Stormy Daniels, which didn't involve AMI or the National Enquirer, was part of a overall scheme that started, right after Trump announced his candidacy for the presidency, that AMI would buy stories, would find stories, would alert the Trump campaign about stories that were negative about Trump, and would buy the stories but not publish them.
Right.
And then somehow AMI would get reimbursed by Trump. Now, that's just a flat out violation of Federal Election Campaign Act, because basically you have an outside entity making contributions and then being reimbursed for the contributions by the candidate. And you can't do that. That's illegal. And in fact, AMI was investigated, and Pecker was investigated by the United States Department of Justice under the prior administration. Who was president then?
was Trump.
Trump. Yeah. Under President Trump's Justice Department actually investigated this. They, as you know, they charged Michael Cohen for violating the Federal Election Campaign Act and committing offenses that, according to the government, in the sentencing memo they submitted to the U.S. District Court, were at the direction of and for the benefit of individual one who was
Trump.
Yes. Okay. And they also investigated AMI for this stuff that's being hashed out in court, involving there was a payoff to they bought off a doorman who made some false allegation against Trump, and then they also paid off Karen McDougal, who Trump did his thing with, whatever you want to call it.
Gross.
And yes, gross. And they expect to be reimbursed by Trump. Anyway, they entered into what was called a non-prosecution agreement with the government, basically conceding they'd done the bad thing and they promised not to do it again. And Pecker was part of that. If what should have happened ideally is that if Trump had not been president, he should have been prosecuted at that time, and Pecker and AMI and Cohen would have been witnesses against him. But he was president and he was immune from prosecution because presidents are considered, although the Supreme Court's never ruled on this, they are considered to be immune from prosecution for anything during the time that they are president, because right. They got to be president. They can't be in jail. They can't be in criminal court. Bottom line is, this Pecker is testifying to all this, and it's setting the stage for the Stormy Daniels payment. Because what happened was they had this set up, and then it kind of got blown up because, first of all, Trump didn't pay AMI back. Okay, surprise, surprise.
I think he would pay the bills on these things.
Well, he ultimately did, but because what happened was he didn't pay the bill, and then also. I don't know whether they got to this testimony today. I have not been following the events of the trial today because I was watching the Supreme Court and then talking about the Supreme Court.
There's a lot of cases. There's a lot of legal stuff.
The other thing that happened was I think Pecker and got advice from his in-house lawyer saying, don't do this. Please do not do this. Stop. And so basically when Stormy Daniels came around, AMI wasn't playing anymore. So they had to figure out some other way to get cash from Trump to Stormy to pay her off before the election. And so they didn't have AMI anymore. So Michael Cohen took out a home equity loan and then got reimbursed later with checks signed by Donald Trump when he was president. So that's Pecker, what's great about Pecker for the prosecution is he sets up the pattern and the motivation and the fact that this was basically all about the election. And why that matters is that it's a crime in New York to falsify business records for any reason. And it's a misdemeanor automatically. But it becomes a felony if you're doing it to effectuate or cover up another crime. And the other crime here is that all of these payoffs were basically done for the purposes of influencing the election, in which case they had to be disclosed, which they weren't. And instead, they were covered up through the use of these false invoices and false checks that were allegedly for a retainer that didn't exist. And, so you've got 35 counts of false business records, and every single one is a felony.
Did you see Trump while you were
there? I did see Trump.
How's he look in there?
Doesn't look happy.
Yeah, this is the reporting is that he seems mad at the world. And
he did not look happy. He didn't look particularly rested or healthy. I got a couple of good looks at him as he walked down.
Did he wave?
I did not. I didn't want to create a scene. And also, I wasn't within, I don't think I was within
that's
his
good judgment,
field of
view. By the way, I think that's correct.
Not yeah, that. I do occasionally exercise good judgment.
Yeah.
I know it's boring, but
restraint on that seems healthy. So what do you like? Are you going to go back down? Are there witnesses you want to see?
Yeah, I'm trying to go down there as much as possible, consistent with my primary job, which is as an Uber driver for my teenage girls.
Sure.
I'm going to try to go down there next week again. I'm going to try to make as much of this trial as possible, and particularly with, the more interesting witnesses.
And we've got probably another month of this trial, right?
I think this trial is going to go through, the mid-May to maybe Memorial Day at worst. I would not be surprised if the Thursday afternoon before Friday afternoon before Memorial Day is when the verdict comes.
Wild. Hey, you know, it reminds me, though, the timeline of this one is just a quick question that I sort of forgot to ask about the immunity question, which is, it does seem like there was a piece in Rolling Stone today that was interesting to me because somebody on Trump's team had kind of gone on background and said, like, yeah, we don't really care how they decide the immunity case because we've already won, because it's kicked the timeline of this to a point where it'll never go to trial before the election. Do you agree with that?
I have a nuanced view, and fundamentally I disagree. And here's the thing. There are two possibilities here. Let's assume the Supreme Court takes as long as it can possibly take with this case, which would be basically to the end of June, June 28th, the last Friday in June, and if the term would end no later than that. If Trump loses outright, then the trial would occur 81 days after that. That is basically the period of time that the judge has allotted from that was previously the original time between when jurisdiction was taken away from her for the appeals and the original trial date. I did the math today, and 81 days after June 28th is September 17, 2024. And I don't see Judge Chutkan saying, oh, it's too close to the election, I'm not going to hold this trial. And I don't see the Justice Department saying, oh, please don't hold this trial. I think they're going to say, well, that's when the trial is. That's when the trial is. So you could end up... Yes, I do not think the case will be tried to verdict. I will agree with the Trump people to that extent. I do not think that the case will be tried to verdict before the election, but I do think that you could end up with the government putting on its entire case in September and October of 2024, which would be quite something.
What happens then if the verdict comes down and he's elected president?
If he's elected president and the verdict comes down, well, you know, he wouldn't serve the time during the time he was president. But anyway, that's one possibility. The other possibility is, and people are talking about this today because they can't figure out what the Supreme Court's going to do, whether it's going to do some kind of possible remand for further proceedings in the district court to figure out, you know, what stuff is prosecutable and what stuff isn't, and what, you know. And again, I think that's all speculation because we actually do not know the rule of law that they are going to set to determine what is an official act that's prosecutable and what is not. But assuming they remanded for some kind of factual findings before the trial, before you could decide to have the trial, well, the problem that faces for Trump is, if I'm Judge Chutkan, I'm going to say, okay, well, they need me to find facts, come back on July 10th at 9 o'clock and present your witnesses. And basically, you could easily see that this could entirely backfire on Trump. The idea of they think they've stalled it past the election. I don't think they've either pushed the trial to September. And if they pushed it beyond that, it's because they're going to have some kind of fact-finding beforehand, and that could happen in July or August. So I actually think that we may have another situation in politics where in law that happens when the dog catches the car. I think he getting what he wants here may not necessarily be what he wants.
Jeez. Okay. All right.
Did that make sense?
It did.
Okay.
So just the one thing I want to ask you about before we get out of here.
Before I do the eyes?
You can do the eyes while you do this. I think you're a talented person. You can multitask. Okay. The Arizona grand jury indicted 18 people, including Giuliani, Meadows, and 11 fake electors, for scheming to prevent the lawful transfer of the presidency. What about this? This just like came down. There's just...
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, there may be at least one or more investigations. I think there's at least one other state that's rumored to be doing it. I forget which one it is. But, I mean, what's good, they did this in all those states. They submitted false electoral certificates. There's no reason why they shouldn't be prosecuted under under state law in any of these states. I haven't had the chance yet because there's so much legal activity that the former president has been causing in courts throughout the country and state.
Yeah, you got to get it around.
I got it around the eyes here. Yeah, you know, in Supreme Court, the Supreme Court in Manhattan, which isn't really the Supreme Court, this is really the trial court and the Supreme Court of the United States. So I haven't had a chance to read the indictment, I confess, but yeah, I mean, it's really, and they got also got in this one they charged Boris Epstein. He got hit on this one too. I don't. This is going to be going on for a while. These cases are going to, you know, they're going to be, we're going to be living with a 2020 election for a couple more years at least, regardless of what happens in 2024.
I just can't sort of stress enough how wild, and by wild, I don't mean it in like a, I mean it in the worst way you could possibly mean it. Like,
no, absolutely.
Come show up on January 6th will be wild, as in people are going to die and people are going to try to overthrow the government. We're entering into a crazy time, which is why, George, I'm so grateful
you came
to explain the legal news for me. And thanks to all of you for listening. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Leave us a review on your podcast app. Email us at askgeorge@thebulwark.com. Get tickets for our live show on May 15th in D.C. And we will see you next week.
Okay. Bye.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last.